Definitely jazzy. Thank you so much to Bill with our big band show this morning coming to a conclusion. And now, yes, it is time for our public affairs show here at WHFR Dearborn. And we call it the new WHFR Journal. Hello and welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal, local news and alternative views. We're getting down to the bones, opening up those closets and seeing what we can see in the nearby area. Dearborn and the surrounding area is what we talk about. And my name is Jay Koronick and happy to be with you today. I'm joined in the studio by my co-host, Angel Gomez. And welcome, Angel.
Good afternoon, Jay.
So glad to have you back with us today. We are going to have a real fast-paced show talking about all the events coming up. We have our stories in front of us, probably more than we can cover in an hour. So I hope our listeners are got their paper and pencil handy for taking notes on all the information we give them. But I want to start with a correction. You know, first of all, we always have that disclaimer, too, somewhere in the hour that the opinions expressed in this show are not necessarily those of anyone else here at Henry Ford Community College, although it's possible. But last week, I want to make this correction to an opinion I had, which was a statement of fact, I thought, and it wasn't. We were talking about the Michigan Fair Tax. It is a proposal to change the way that the state raises money from us instead of an income tax. And so go check out the website and go to Journal for the archives of that show if you missed it. I think it went on over half an hour with the deputy director for the state of Michigan Fair Tax organization. Anyway, during that, we talked about the people who were in support of it. The bill was introduced in the Congress in Washington, D.C. by Representative John Linder, who's a Republican from Georgia. But it was a proposal that's been around for quite a while. He's introduced it for 5 or 6 years now to the Congress, so about 10 years it's been kicking around there. It does have 44 co-sponsors right now, but apparently one of them is not Representative Dennis Kucinich, Democrat from Ohio in the House. I misstated that. I was looking here at the American Free Press, if you want to know how these things happen, folks, other than just general incompetency. And the American Free Press is a weekly newspaper that talks about the issues of our country, and they call themselves populist and independent. They're not Republican or Democrat. They are available that you can look them up. They're a real newspaper. They're not one organization or another, but it's just a weekly. They do send it out by mail, or you can get it online exclusively, AmericanFreePress.net. Well, the article about Linder was at the top of the page on the right, and the top of the page on the left had Kucinich's picture, and it says, Maverick Ohio Rep says Federal Reserve can be dismantled. And I thought, Federal Reserve, that's the same thing as the IRS. And of course it isn't. The Federal Reserve is a banking institution, you know, and the IRS is the IRS, Internal Revenue Service. And but he does have proposals to limit the power of the Federal Reserve to issue money. And it's quite a complicated issue. And I read through the whole article for today and could not quite understand the point he's getting to, except it's all based on a concept in a book that he had been reading, I guess, that he quoted from in his press release on how he wants to redo the Federal Reserve. And so for our readers out there in the audience, and get your pencil going here that I told you you needed to have, The Lost Science of Money is the title of the book. Stephen Zarlenga, Zarlenga, and that's the book that Kucinich got his information from about reforms to the Federal Reserve System that, of course, he believes might have got us out of that mess we got into, the one we're currently in, as well as this issue of when we issue more money, we go, the country itself goes deeper in debt. It sounds like a bunch of account book juggling to me. I mean, I don't think we should be issuing more paper money unless, as Ron Paul has proposed, we go back to the gold standard or something. It should be based on something, not just thin air or goodwill, if you will, because goodwill only lasts so long and then people turn ugly. And we might see, of course, rampant inflation. Don't say not gloom and doom about this, folks. But anyway, so now you understand that Kucinich should not have been included. However, other people on the far left, like a former senator from Alaska, Mike Gravel, who ran for the Democratic presidential position, didn't win, of course. He was for the fair tax. And Mike Huckabee, who ran for the Republican nomination, and, of course, he didn't get the nomination either, but he was for the same fair tax proposal, and we just think everybody should study it because the Michigan Fair Tax Group is going to be moving ahead. And I think what we should do with our first story is actually try to find, and now we have all our papers here, find the story about the, it's Tom Watkins' editorial about the constitutional thing. I think I gave it to you. No? Okay.
Nope, you have that, Jay.
Oh, well, okay. In that case, okay, I'll look it up here then. There is an editorial that's usually in the Times Herald, and I'm missing some pages here. Okay, we'll find it. And when we come across it, we'll feature it. It talks about in 2010 when we're going to have the question asked to us, and it has to be asked to us every few years by the Michigan Constitution, whether we want to have a constitutional convention. Ah, there we go. That's why I have a co-host. Okay. And so it's going to come up in 2010, and I highly recommend, as does Tom Watkins, their guest columnist at the Press and Guide. I thought it was in Times Herald. That was my mistake. Excuse me, Times Herald, or commend me, Press and Guide, for getting it right here. And so the last constitution in the state of Michigan was adopted in 1963. And the Michigan citizens are asked every 16 years if they wish to convene a constitutional convention to revise the laws that govern the state, either a few of them or all of them or whatever they want to do. Okay? And so that question, do you want to have a constitutional convention, is going to be raised to the voters next year. I guess probably in November. It's a big deal, so it'll probably be November of 2010, not before then, probably. And a lot has changed, Tom Watkins says, since 1963, certainly true. And he goes on to say, if you're satisfied with the way the state has been governed and believe the framers of our Constitution in 1963, and what is that anyway, 45 years ago. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. I was young then.
Yeah, okay. Got to be quick on math on this show. It says, have provided the solid foundation on which we should be governed in the 21st century, global, technology-driven, knowledge economy. He says, well, you can vote a resounding no when this question comes up if you think that that's still good. But of course, there's a lot of things that have not been maximized in that proposal. And I was thinking of the Times Herald editor who passed, Frank Bewick, very sadly, last December at the end of the year. And he was in favor of some things that actually can be resolved in the state of Michigan by a constitutional convention. And I won't read the entire editorial here because we have other stories today. But Tom Watkins himself, of course, always thought that it was crazy to actually vote for by party the people who are running for the boards of trusteeship, or the Board of Governors, or I think they call it Board of Governors, of Wayne State University, University of Michigan, and so on, and the State Board of Ed. Why? Because nobody really knows who these people are. You vote for them according to their party affiliation. And sort of just to be, I don't know, somewhat crazed about this, I always vote for the Green Party for those positions. Because what damage could they do? Were they going to, you know, if they actually do get in, are they going to plant more trees on those campuses? What are they? I mean, you know, run the campuses more energy efficient. That's all well and good. I mean, you know, Green Party people in those positions won't hurt anything. But just, you know, I don't know any of them. And of course, most people would say, well, I'm a Republican, so I'll vote for the Republicans. Well, why not just appoint them? You know, I mean, whoever gets a governorship, of course, then they're all going to be Democrats or Republicans, depending on who the governor is. But that's just one thing he brings up. He just says, do we need to elect these positions? And then he goes on to say, do we need a full-time legislature? Now, that's something that Frank Bewick talked about. He thinks we should have now a part-time legislature, since they only work part-time anyway. Even when they're in session, they only have a required 4 days a week schedule, which they can scoot out from anytime they want to and no penalty. Although some people said, like even in Congress, if they're not there for a vote, they get their pay subtracted, or they have to have a note from their mother if they're going to be absent, or not from their mother, but an explanation written out that's valid, you know, about why they couldn't make the session. That's a little picky, I think. If people are really doing their jobs, they need more flexibility. But in fact, they're not in session all the time. They have, I think it's only 8 or 9 months that they're actually in session doing laws in Lansing, and it's only 4 days a week that they actually even have to be there. And some of them, depending on how they schedule that, they don't really have to be there all those 4 days. They don't have a committee meeting, or there's nothing else they have to do, and they don't even have to be in Lansing. So, in effect, we kind of have a part-time legislature anyway. Wouldn't it be great to have a six-month legislature that has to be there 5 days a week for a full 6 months? That would work out to be more days, you see, actually. And maybe we get more done, or would they just, as it's happened with our legislature, just put it off until the end of the session, and then they get crazy. Well, we got to pass it or the state's out of money. I mean, I don't know. Well, you have an opinion?
Well, I do have an opinion on that, actually.
So. That's why he's here, folks.
Okay, I finally get to say, hey. but anyways, time with the constituency. That's the reason that they only have the four-day work week.
Sure.
Be able to get back to their home base, meet with the people from their communities, poll them as to their views, as this is a representative government. Therefore, having contact with the people that you're representing is not a bad thing.
I've heard that argument, and of course, it's been a sort of a tradition here in Dearborn that our representative from the Michigan legislature, from the House of Representatives, currently Gino Polidori, that they have scheduled 2 hours the last Friday of each month, so we just missed them here, at the Ford Community and Performing Arts Center in some of the senior meeting rooms over there in that facility. That's only 2 hours. But theoretically, yes, he could be back in the community for other things, sitting in the office, phone calls, meeting with people that want to talk to him locally. And I don't know how heavy a schedule that is. But that is very noble, and it's very appropriate. I agree with you on that. So maybe that's a reason either to vote. Well, we'll see what the proposal is, of course. Here's another idea, a unicameral government in Michigan. Not two houses. That's bicameral, folks, not a type of camel. Bicameral is two houses, which is what, of course, our federal government has, a House of Representatives and a Congress, a Senate. That makes up our Congress, those two houses. But in at least one state I know of, and I think it's Nebraska, but maybe it's Kansas. I'll do a correction in 2 weeks. They have a unicameral government, which means they have one body, and they have committees. And then the bill comes out of the committee, and the group votes on it up or down. They don't have to negotiate with another house about it. And so theoretically, bills can be discussed and very seriously voted on, and there's no chance to, I don't know, add pork, or very little chance to add so-called pork to it, much less beef or chicken. Bad joke. Okay. You know, these little bills that are just sort of helping little communities build a statue to somebody or something, or, you know, what stuff that maybe should just be done locally. Often those kinds of extra little funding bills are tossed in there, and everybody loves them. It's fun if it's spread out evenly, but it costs the government a lot of money, as many of you know. I think it was some Republican that mentioned that the current budget bill that was passed, the omnibus budget bill, the U.S. budget for this country for next year, has 6,000 pork bills attached, 6,000 projects, and it could be more than that. And, of course, Barack Obama campaign saying, I will eliminate all pork and I will not approve any bill, but they need the money for the other stuff. So the pork is just a small percentage of the total bill. And so they're going to go ahead with it. I mean, it's passed, and he's going to sign it. And it's got 6,000 little projects that perhaps, I think, if they're going to be done, should be done locally somehow. But that's pragmatism. If you know anything about government, and I've been part of groups that have associated with it, I've seen it on the inside, never been elected myself, except a high school president, but that class president. But other than that, it is a strange world, folks, in politics. It's not totally corrupt, but there's a lot of compromises with our kind of governmental system that have to be made to get bills passed, and that's a reality. I mean, we'd love to say, truth and justice will win out, and we don't need compromise at all. We need, of course, appropriate revision and comment from everybody. I wish it could just be consensus even, but that never seems to work when you have two parties fighting it out. If you just had good-thinking, good-spirited people, it may not be that bad.
I would settle for just the amount of time it takes to read the bill, because as you may recall, yeah, they just passed an 1,100-page stimulus package that nobody had an opportunity to read prior to voting on it. It's those type of things that we as normal citizens, so to speak, or the citizenry of the community, cannot understand that, because when we are, it's incumbent upon us, when we receive notices from our credit card companies or any changes, that we read through all of it. They don't even get a chance to read on that, and they pass legislature that affects us.
Yeah, I would suspect that some of, with all due respect, some of our elected officials wouldn't understand it if they read through all of it anyway. That's why they have people in their office that assist their office that are policy experts and specialists, and they assign them to read it all. But absolutely, I know the Patriot Act came like in the middle of the night after 9/11, it was 3 months later or something, and nobody had a chance to read it. They voted on 6:30 that morning. They only had it for 2 hours. So even the people in the office who might have been the policy experts working for the representatives had no time to read it either. But, hey, we're all for patriotism, so you can't vote against it. Of course, that was a complete misnomer. It's just a way to eliminate a lot of our justice system, like innocent until proven guilty. I'm sorry, there's another Freudian slip. That's what we have now. As long as the Patriot Act is in effect, government says you're guilty, and you go away without right to counsel or judicial process, at least for a while. So Tom Watkins does say, though, he also mentions last, just to conclude his editorial about the Constitutional Convention possibility for next year, for at least being voted on next year, probably wouldn't convene until the year after that, 2011. The current Constitution prohibits a graduated income tax. So if you want to revisit the whole question of income tax or the fair tax, or whether you want to graduate it instead of a flat rate for everybody, that would be a place to do it too, in that Constitutional Convention. Some people, he says at the end here, and this is the fair part of his editorial, some people will argue, let sleeping dogs lie. Okay? Or it should be sleeping dogs lay. Anyway, you don't want a dog telling falsehoods, do you? But in any event, he concludes by saying, he says that opening the state constitution review will bring out every quote-unquote wacko intent on cementing into the Constitution every pet grieve they have, including banning stem cell research, legalizing marijuana, allowing prayer in public schools. You've heard about these. There's been petition drives, of course, and that's maybe the right place to try these out with the public in general. Of course, once the Constitutional Convention gets proposals together, the public votes on it as a package, one big package, which means that little parts of it, a lot of people might disagree with, but they think the whole package is so improved, they vote for it. So yeah, it is a time when special interests, whether they're wacko or not, Tom, can get things into the Constitution. And maybe if they're not the major focus or the major idea, the public will be inclined to vote for the package and therefore get some of these outsider ideas in there. Personally, I think Michigan fair tax is not an outsider idea, is not wacko. Just one example of that. I'm sure that the abortion rights people and so on and parochial schools want federal funding or government funding, and oh my gosh, permitting assisted suicide, allowing capital punishment in the state, hang them by the neck.
Put that in as a constitutional earmark.
Yeah, if you can. I don't know. And he says, you know, once approved in the new Constitution, only a constitutional amendment voted on by the people could make changes. So that's probably, that rarely happens, of course. Nonetheless, he thinks it's time to consider that, be aware of it, and probably vote for it. Yeah, open up the can of worms and maybe... Who eats worms? Anyway, maybe the worms will do us some good. You know, there's protein in worms, isn't there, in this starving economic time? Okay, well, so there's the constitutional review issues. Let's see, where do we want to jump next here? Oh, we just have so many ideas. I wanted to mention that, I think I mentioned last week, Burton Katzman's lawyers, the developer of West Dearborn, have responded to the lawsuit, and basically the city and Mayor O'Reilly, to sum it up, to say that they said, yeah, sure, of course they claim they didn't do anything wrong and that it was impossible to complete the project because of the bad economy. Well, of course, that's not in a contract, so it'll be interesting to see what the judges will say when this comes in front of a judge. Is that a way out of any contract because the economy made it impossible to further develop West Dearborn? You know, they couldn't borrow money or there wouldn't be clients. Even if they built the thing, people wouldn't come. That's what they're saying. Well, if that's a principle of law, then all these people who can't pay on their mortgages get to keep their houses free and clear, I guess. I mean, I can't see that the judges will support Burton Katzman on this. Are you a lawyer, Angel? No, but okay.
Not a lawyer, but have an opinion on that in the sense that too many times people, I think a lot of people that are paying their mortgages are starting to resent the fact that people that are not paying their mortgages are getting bailed out. However, when they see the foreclosure down the street, it affects them. Just as Mr. Katzman said, he predicated his business on investing into a property that is no longer viable as it once mm-hmm. was, and he's trying to renegotiate.
Yeah.
The renegotiation tactic is fair. However, I do agree that once you make the deal, that's the deal.
Well,
live with it.
You're stuck with what you signed, you know, unless
exactly.
it can be renegotiated. And the city apparently has tried to talk to them about these things, and they weren't really open, or maybe they had impossible situations. I think the city indicated that they couldn't even get in touch with them for several months, much less renegotiate anything. And the city, of course, doesn't want to lose out on what they promised, so rightly so. I think the courts will hold them to the quick, as they say. Mayor O'Reilly had a proposal that he introduced last Wednesday morning at the Hyatt Regency in Dearborn, and they're of course interested in this because he wants the community, one kind of funding or the other, to develop a conference center that is a lot of meeting rooms, big auditorium, right next to the Hyatt Regency in Dearborn. Now I guess there's room there. There's a big parking lot just to the east of the Hyatt Regency. There's a road that goes through there. Behind them, I know there's an apartment complex, so-called luxury apartments. Haven't seen them up close, but and I guess there is a little land there that they could build this extra complex there on that. And that would make us a destination for conventions and big meetings. And, you know, different national groups could come here because, hey, you know, what sort of attractions do we have? Well, we got Greenville Village, Henry Ford Museum, and, you know, other things. But, I mean, we do have shopping, as it is, in West Dearborn right now and at the Fairlane Town Center. So a small conference, I would think, for 3 or 4 days, they'd be more than occupied with what's going on here in Dearborn. But even the hotels themselves don't have a large enough space for a large conference. Also, like an expo hall, usually many conferences have vendor tables in addition to presentations where the vendors, you know, talk about their business and give out information and so on. I'm familiar with the National Association of Broadcasters meeting even the film conference that I'm going to next week in Austin, Texas. And yes, Angel will be here in my place. The show will go on, right, Angel?
And I Absolutely. Will be doing my homework for this that
okay.
next show.
I bet
I promise.
I just threw papers at him today, you know. And we're going to have an exciting guest next week, as long as we're talking about this right now. That's going to be, we hope, barring her busy schedule.
Jennifer Knott from the Dearborn Chamber of Commerce.
Jennifer Knott Gehring.
Jennifer Knott Gehring.
Gehring, yes. She's not Gehring. Yes, she is Gehring. No, she's not Gehring.
She answers to all three
Bad
names.
Joke.
I asked her the question yesterday. I asked her, what name do you prefer? And she did say that she probably will be moving towards Knott. So Jennifer Knott.
No, I think Jennifer Knott Gehring. I think it's the whole name. Although some people, you know, some women call themselves Marie Anne. So it's, they want to be called by their middle name along with their first name. So, well, you got to research that for next week because we don't want to make Jennifer uncomfortable.
We will have the news tomorrow. We'll ask that right here on the Dearborn Journal.
I always do that bad joke about Jennifer not caring. Yes, she is. No, she isn't. You know, okay. But she's the president of Dearborn Chamber of Commerce, and they're a great organization, and they're struggling to help business in Dearborn more than usual now. And we'll mention one of their events coming up at the end of the show that they're working on with the Dearborn Board of Realtors, too. But so where would the money come from? Okay, I'll turn the page. Okay, that's always the exciting part. The devil is in the details. I'm sorry, God is in the details. Well, one or the other. Maybe both. I don't know. But it's always good to read the details in these stories because maybe if you discover about the funding issues, you're not in favor of it. You know, if, you know, so sometimes the details make a big difference. He thinks it could, this conference center could bring in, this is O'Reilly, millions in revenue. Okay, each year, along with 93,000 sold hotel rooms a year, 93,000 more. Shopping, eating. He said, we have hockey, baseball, football, if you drive him downtown. He says, we have hockey, baseball, and even football. And that was a mocking reference to the Detroit Lions, of course, and their success story, or lack of it. And he says, it's not pie in the sky. And he thinks it's going to take a while. It may not be finished for more than 5 years, and he may not even be mayor at that point, he admits, but he thinks we should work towards that. So they don't talk about funding here, but they're hoping it can come from a number of sources out there. Also, and I think it's here, yes, update news on the, and then we'll take a break with some important non-commercial messages, update news on the City of Dearborn schools. And they are the most important thing in the community because they provide the education for the future of our community. And, of course, if we don't have a good community, that future will go to other communities, too. So there's another issue there. But basically, you know, we reported here, and it was very sad, that the Dearborn Public Schools expected to have to cut $11 million from their budget. Laying off, well, if not laying off teachers, giving everybody a big pay cut. And, of course, teachers don't deserve a pay cut. They're not the most highly paid people in the world, folks, believe me, as having been one for 40 years. But then Granholm announced about 3 weeks ago that the state could not support even the funding guidelines that she gave previously, like 2 or 3 months ago. And that in Dearborn, it meant that we'd have to cut another $6+ million. For a total of about $17 million somehow out of the budget in order to break even, which the schools have to do. They can't use deficit spending. They actually have to do, like you and me, budget so we're not in the hole each month. So what happened, though, was, and this is the good news, because the Dearborn Public Schools are having a terrible time trying to figure out what are they supposed to do here. It looks like some of the stimulus bill that's coming back to the states for distribution will be used to make up that six, in Dearborn's case, that $6 million difference. And so we're still stuck with $11 million cuts, but it won't be this disastrous $17 million due to the state's poor economy. So that's the good news. In other words, it's still bad, but it's not any worse, just in case you were confused about that. So keep your fingers crossed, though, folks, that money is not here yet. We're going to take a brief break for non-commercial messages. Listen up. They're all extremely important, as always, here on WHFR. Dearborn, WHFR.FM, the station, making waves.
Close your eyes in Chicago, and you can hear the sound of zebra braying in Africa. Look hard out your window in D.C., and you can see the snow-covered peaks of the Andes. The world is that small. We are that connected. Please visit earthshare.org and learn how the world's leading environmental groups are working together. Earthshare, one environment, one simple way to care for it all. A public service message from Earthshare and the Ad Council.
You may already know that Henry Ford Community College has been educating our local community for over 70 years. You may also already know that HFCC offers a job skills guarantee, a credit transfer guarantee, and even a tuition freeze guarantee. But did you know that the start of the second 8-week classes for the winter of 2009 is coming up on March 16th? If you haven't already signed up for a class or two, you should consider signing up for any of the 20 different 8-week classes available, including classes in allied health, business and management, computer applications, hospitality, or even nursing. There are even many telecommunication classes being offered, including TCM 189, which is a staff training class for WHFR. To find out more information on these classes and many more, visit www.hfcc.edu or call 1-800-585-HFCC. Henry Ford Community College, your best choice, guaranteed.
Highway 61, the longest highway that I know. Highway 61, the longest highway that I know.
Highway 61 offers nothing but the finest in a wide variety of blues every Friday from 2 until 6 p.m. From the front porch to the concert stage, featuring local, national, and international blues, Highway 61 has something just for you. I'm Joanne Korchenska, and you are welcome to join me as I cruise down that historic highway every Friday from 2 until 6 p.m. Only on WHFR.FM, the station making waves. Independent radio at its very best since 1985.
We're back with our Friday edition. It's always Friday if you're listening to us as we're recording it, of course, but if you're on the internet, it could be any day at all. From WHFR.FM, click on the journal button. You can listen to the show anytime at all, or put it on your iPod and go jogging with it. That's we got to keep the beat going, though. That's in order to make that happen. Anyway, bad jokes. I always have to say bad jokes because some people think I might be serious about this, and then they just think I'm crazy. You know, well, that didn't make any sense. No, but it's supposed to keep you listening closely for the good stuff. Okay. Good stuff here. Last week, I didn't get a chance to feature this because we had some guests and some, two guests, actually, one pre-recorded. Jack Lessenberry in the Metro Times newspaper. Weekly newspaper, mentioned Ismail Ahmed, our former local director of access, and now, of course, he has been appointed, and he's serving as the director of the Michigan Department of Human Services. So it's kind of entertaining. I'm going to read this as quickly as I can, but with emotion. Ismail, and this is from Jack Lessenberry, it's his words, Ismail Ahmed, director of Michigan Department of Human Services, is mostly bald. Which is a good thing, because despite his usually calm exterior, I'd be fearful he'd be tempted to tear his hair out in the months ahead. I certainly would, in his shoes. Michigan is facing an explosion in poverty and need, and families slipping below the waterline, just at a time when he knows he is going to have to do much, much more with less money. Quote from Ismail, there's an explosion of need out there, he said. We've seen a dramatic increase in poverty in the state. More than one-fourth of children are living in poverty.
That's an incredible figure.
That's a scary thing, yeah. I could toss some more out. But anyway, he went on to say more than 2 million people, including children, are living below the poverty line, and that's still increasing. And when you count people who are working but who just don't make enough to live, that increases to about a third of the state. In other words, they're working, so they're not unemployed technically, but it's like a part-time job or something, or a low-paying job full-time, and they're at the poverty level. And that's a third of the state, one in three. Normally, that would be reason, says Lessenberry, for him to ask for more money to do his job, but there is no more money. Worse, the state is facing the mother of all deficits in the next fiscal year, at least $1.5 billion. I hadn't heard that number before, but that's what's looming next year for the state budget. The huge budget cuts are coming, says Lessenberry. Thanks to rising unemployment, Ahmed's department was mostly spared in the first go-round of cuts, though DHS, his Department of Health and Human Services, did lose $100 million, mostly for after-school programs. But more cuts could well be coming if the state budget situation worsens. In the meantime, he's going to have to do more with less. Oh, make that a lot more. When it comes to people being down in their luck, we most likely ain't seen nothing yet, says Lessenberry. Some of those who are certain to lose jobs, even if the domestic automakers all survive, haven't lost them yet. Others are still existing off hope, savings, and unemployment compensation while it lasts. And of course, it was unnerving to hear that the independent auditors said the GM is going to go bankrupt. They haven't filed for it yet, but there is no way, even if they get the $16.4 billion that the government said, well, if you have a plan that shows your viability, we'll give you the rest of the $30 billion, which is $16.4 billion coming back to, I don't know if that's GM alone or GM and Chrysler, but the independent auditors that are working on this viability proposal say, with GM's current plan for viability that they haven't submitted yet, it's March 31st, they have to submit this, they're still not going to do it. They're still not going to be viable. They're going to have to file bankruptcy. There's no way out of that. And, of course, bankruptcy means, at best, reorganization. A lot of people who were who had sold goods and services to GM won't get paid or get paid a fraction of what their services cost. GM will maybe break apart into several companies. A lot of people further will be out of work. There's no doubt about that. Even if a few of the car brands can survive, whether or not GM will hold together with only one or two brands, but that reorganization is going to be a disaster. And then often in bankruptcy, the reorganizations don't work. A couple of years later, you try it, you still can't figure it out. And so the whole company just is gone, and they sell off the factories, the land, the bits and pieces, and it's just gone. And so that doesn't look good for Michigan, certainly, because there's some GM plants here as well as around the world. Do you have an auto comment to make
it's,
on this?
It's just a shame because it's such a catch-22. You know, initially, I wouldn't be a type of person that would say bailout. I think 65% of the country right now feels as though we should not be assisting the auto companies. Here in Dearborn, obviously, we have a vested interest in it, albeit Ford did not approach the government yet for money. But putting all this money into these companies, they say it's poor business model and that the market cannot sustain them as they are right now. What's confusing to me is in 2007, the world bought about 16.5 million cars. Mm-hmm. Now they're projecting, even in better case scenarios, that market will go down to about 10 to 12. That loss of income.
I heard 8 or 9 in this country, but
a drastic reduction in income obviously is not going to be good for a balance sheet, and I don't think they can scale down fast enough.
Yeah.
But there's so many intricacies that are costing. It's just like Visteon with Ford Motor Company. Visteon trading for 2 cents a share right now. Now taking on the over the board, they're about to go under business. Where does Ford get its parts?
Here's a survey of one, and I'm not going to do this as an online thing, folks. But, you know, if you ever want to send any comments about the Journal Show, send them to whfr@hfcc.edu and just put in the subject line Journal so that it comes to me or who's ever around at the time, and it'll be printed out in a day or two and given to the appropriate person here if I'm not around next week. So anytime you want to send comments, questions, please feel free to do so. We'd love to see what you're listening to. But here's the question for Angel, my subject today. Are you driving a Made in America automobile right now?
Ford Mustang.
Okay, he was proud of that, so he told us it didn't have to be that personal. Okay, would you feel, if you didn't have the Mustang, would you feel, and you needed a new car, and Ford didn't exist, let's say, that you could buy a GM car or a Chrysler car right now? Or would you be a little concerned about their longevity issue?
Well, that's the issue that GM is bringing up, in the sense that with the word bankruptcy associated with them, who would be inclined to buy them? How would they get it serviced? Would the warranty be honored? Where would they be able to? Would they be able to have parts to be able to fix it should it be damaged? They have run tests themselves. GM has said, and that the word bankruptcy would scare off a large percentage of potential customers.
I think the current I think their stock fell to $1.80 a share, although Ford's has been down that low already, but it GM's was much, much higher like a year ago. Was it $60 or $80 a share? It was much, much higher because they're a big company, you know, and hey, big companies are always gonna be around, right? And they're always gonna be making a profit for you, so people buy. But
it was front page news when it dropped below $10 a share. Yeah. I remember they had front page coverage. Now it's below $2.
Right. Well, just briefly summing up the Lessenberry article, I mean, I would be concerned, to answer the question myself that I asked, I would be concerned about buying a GM or Chrysler car. You might get a great value if you think that the car is well-made, because they're given fantastic discounts right now, at least Chrysler seems to be, at least for employees anyway, at Chrysler. And, parts will probably be available by any reorganization for a while, because after a year or so, usually there's a third-party parts manufacturers that jump in to make the parts, especially since the manufacturer doesn't want to make them forever. So I think it's 1 year to 3 years that you get the third parties jumping in. Well, they'll just probably jump in sooner if the company is gone to make parts for those cars for that year. If there was a significant number made, people will need new parts in a couple of years. And so I think the parts issue won't be a problem. Most cars wear out or traded in before 7 or 10 years, and so, although maybe they shouldn't be, but I don't think people should worry about that. In terms of the warranty coverage, I am told that somehow the government, sort of like insuring the money in your banks, will take up warranty costs as long as the car is under warranty. Those Chryslers, I'm sorry, they have lifetime warranty on the drivetrains, or is it 7 or 10 years? Well, anyway, it's a very long time just on the engines, and that doesn't mean their engines are better necessarily. But
with all that being said, in deference to your question, would I buy an American if Ford was not around? Mm-hmm. I'm going to buy Ford for the rest of my existence on this planet as long as I can.
Well, Frank Bewick could say, God bless you.
And if Ford should not happen to be around, and it was GM Chrysler, or even an American Motors remake or what have you, should it become mm-hmm. an American car company? The answer is yes. I would buy off the American car makers rather than a Toyota, Lexus, or mm-hmm. Mercedes in German. And I would do that just because that is how I feel. It's probably based more on emotion and sense of citizenry than anything else.
Well, and to support local business, whatever it is, although Ford is an international company, I mean, their headquarters are here, but they make a lot of money, and they hope to make more money worldwide. In fact, eventually, they may be making more money worldwide than here if they stay in business, and that's because there's more people in the rest of the world than there are here if they can raise their standard of living to afford a car, or if Ford can make cheap cars for those people in those countries with limited incomes, then Ford is really an international company, and most of its business will not be in this company probably in the future. But I can understand that impulse, and I would just, as I've said in the past, I do not own an American-made car because I think I have a car that's actually better made and have the features that I want that I can't get from an American car, including current Ford cars. But as I said last week, and maybe the week before I stumbled on it, after visiting a Fairlane Ford, okay, I mentioned him, and I just 2 weeks ago, not to buy a car, but just to visit a former student of mine, who happens to be a salesman over there. But that's not a reason to buy over there, folks. I'm not doing a commercial, no. I'm just saying that that we talked, and he indicated they just seen the new 2010 Ford Fusion Hybrid, and I think they're taking orders for the 2010 right now. I'm not sure when it's coming in. Even the new Mustang, they have cars that have coming up, in their 2010 line, that have some of the features and some of the improvements. For example, the Edge, not that anybody noticed, but Consumer Reports said that their brakes weren't as good as other SUVs for the Edge. And they were good, but they weren't as good, and they weren't superior, certainly. And the suspension was a little fluffy and, throw the car out of control. And if you had to do an evasive maneuver at expressway speed, it might be a little, well, of course, the Explorers were always like that. But nonetheless, I like something that has firmer suspension and better handling, even if I'm not going to drive fast. I want the best brakes, by golly. And so I avoided the Edge last time around. But Ford's improved that. So Ford has made some real good improvements. They have an attractive model line that also has some great mechanical changes, not the best in the world maybe, but world class nonetheless for 2010. And in 2011, they're bringing the Ford Fiesta and starting to build in the U.S. the European Ford Focus, the British Ford Focus, European Ford Focus, which is a much better car, although the current Ford Focus is not a bad car, but a much better car. So they already, as I've said even last year, they're on a good plan for the future, and they are local. And so people should consider buying local and good stuff. I think it's a mistake to use your money, which is like a vote, to buy stuff that's inferior. Okay, like at Walmart. Even if it's cheap, folks, is it going to last very long? Is it going to fall apart? Is it made in China? Are you supporting the economy of China? Well, you got to do what you got to do, you know, but just, okay. So, Ishmael, we know that you have a tough time up there in Lansing with the Department of Human Services, and we have a lot of needy people in the state. So we hope that you can be as creative as you have been at Access to use a little bit of money in a wonderful way. And as he said, you need a large movement of people to make a change in government and social services, that everybody has to support education as well as social services, especially in these difficult times, especially now. Okay. Moving away from the microphone, where'd he go? Where'd he go? Wanted to mention this article, too. I showed it to Angel before we went on the air. I'm a member, and I subscribe to a magazine that's called FAIR. Now, nobody can be against FAIR, right? But that stands for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. And they have a monthly magazine, which you won't find at, you know, most bookstores as a periodical, because who's concerned about fairness in reporting? You know, not many people, apparently, since the ratings are so high for certain TV cable news channels that are often inaccurate, and they're full of pundits, commentators, entertainers, not people that are really well-educated, not, you know, PhDs. And even when they get a PhD on those shows, they give them like 5 or 10 minutes, and they carefully screen them to make sure they don't disagree too much. I mean, Glenn Beck always brings some pretty good academics and writers onto his show, and he's now on Fox. But it's interesting. There are always people that say, Glenn, you're absolutely right about that, after he gives them the introduction, after he does the story telling his opinion. And they come on and say, Glenn, you're absolutely right. Do you think they talk to them in advance before they booked them for the show? Yes. Yes. You know, very rarely does he or even Bill O'Reilly have somebody that doesn't agree with them booked for the show. But they try to do that like once in 10 times. Well, FAIR actually tracks these things. They actually watch each show, and they check facts. They check facts. And one thing that they're very upset about right now is what we mentioned, the stock market going up or down, and we mentioned GM price shares and so on. And so here's the story from FAIR. To hear some in the corporate media tell it, you judge a president by how the Dow Jones Industrial Average is performing, and thus Barack Obama is not doing a very good job. As NBC's Meet the Press host David Gregory said, this is just last Sunday, March 1st, he said, quote, the Obama stimulus package, $787 billion. The housing plan, $75 billion. That's $2.3 trillion. $750 billion additional in this document for additional bailout money for the banks. Meanwhile, what metric, what measurement standard, do we have to see how people, what people think of that government intervention? The Dow, he says, is one metric. It closed on Friday at its lowest level since 1997, just over 7,000. And they point out here, without going into it, that MSNBC host Chris Matthews also talked about the Dow Jones as the best indicator of either a popularity poll for the president or for the success of his policies. Okay. And Jim Cramer, NBC's financial pundit, even went further. Is that the crazy guy? The mad money guy, mad Jim money. Cramer, yeah. John Stewart did a sort of a montage of Cramer over the last year, talking about even in these difficult economic times, you should buy this, you should buy that. I think he's given up on that philosophy now, but he's wrong. And so, you know, don't listen to these people, especially if you happen to be one of those few that can be an investor. But Cramer said that Obama is pursuing a radical agenda, quote unquote, that amounts, quote, to the greatest wealth destruction I've seen by a president, unquote. When reporter Aaron Burnett seemed to disagree slightly, Cramer retorted, the stock market is the country right now. This is where people's wealth is, unquote. And this is the FAIR response. Reporters and commentators are mistaken if they believe the Dow Jones average amounts to a public referendum on the Obama White House, or any other White House for that matter. There is also little evidence that a rising stock market is necessarily tied to increased prosperity or broad economic health. It is a measure of what people who trade stocks think those stocks are worth. i.e. how much they think other traders would pay for them. That's literally true, folks, okay? So are you a stock trader? You, yourself? Are you concerned about selling to another stock trader? These are not average people, okay? It's not people like you and me, basically. Even though I own some stocks, why did I? And I bought them last December. Is that crazy? Not because Jim Cramer told me to, but because I wanted to support some local American institutions. It's like giving Christmas presents. I don't even expect to make any money, although last month I'm told I made $12. But and it's not thousands. It was a couple hundred, okay? It was just a token. Okay, I bought some shares in Ford. Does that make you happy, Angel? He's nodding.
I feel
there.
Better now.
Okay. Because I think, you know, some of these companies that are making good products that are local, that I didn't, you know, buy stock to make money. Duh. Isn't that weird? I bought it just as like a Christmas present to some companies I think deserve to stay in business. Now, I'm bound to lose everything, maybe, or make nothing. That $12 was probably an exception. You know, for 10 years. And even then, who knows? I know the Japanese, and you were going to say something about the Japanese, and we may get time to do it here. We only have 9 minutes left, though. But the Japanese had a real downturn, folks, way before we did. And now it's been 10 plus years, almost 20 years, and they're still, the stocks haven't recovered there. People that bought stocks when they were low, they still haven't made a profit on them. They haven't lost anymore, but it's 20 years. The stock market hasn't jumped back. That's scary. So please listen to FAIR. And in fact, Dean Baker, an intelligent person, wrote in response to a Washington Post article, the value of the Dow is not a reliable indicator of much of anything. He said, and this is from March the 3rd, Tuesday, as should be apparent at this point, the stock market can often be driven by irrational exuberance. Remember, it was almost three times as high in 2009 dollars back in 2000 as it is today. Does that make any sense? No, it doesn't. And he says it took only 14 trading sessions for the Dow to fall from 8,000 to less than 7,000. So don't, and I think a lot of people do watch TV and maybe even starting to watch these financial channels now to find out, oh, what's the economy doing? The stock market is an indicator of a lot of things. But, you know, a company's stock can go down to zero and they can stay in business and they can still make great products that you might even want to buy. You don't want to buy the stock, although zero is a good price, I guess. I'll buy it for zero. Give me 10,000 shares. No, make it 1 million shares at zero. But it, you know, it's there. So you got to really understand what the Dow Jones and the stock market numbers really mean. It's really insider information for people that, pardon the expression, and all due respect to traders who are extremely greedy and also itchy on the trigger every day. Ooh, it went up a penny. Let's sell and buy something else. You know, they're always trying to incrementally jump from one to the other to make a killing over the whole week or the whole month. That, you know, before it drops, ooh, now we'll sell it because we're one penny ahead or $10 ahead or something. And so I do want to just add my own suspicion to the meaning of the Dow Jones. That just because it's still dropping, unless, of course, you have savings in those stocks still.
Jay, you have to think about it, though. A lot of what stock is an ownership in a company, an investment into a company.
Yeah.
And when the stocks go down, people are less confident in investing in any company. And that's why, as you've seen it, the numbers come down. It's right now with Ford at $1.80, $1.90, a little less than $2. It sounds like a great deal. But if you don't think Ford is going to be around 3 years from now, 4 years from now, you're going to have some problems. However, if you feel that can go to $5 to $10 a share, you want to buy it. Do you feel confident in the way forward as they speak? I feel confident that you made a good investment there. However, I also want to add that you said that there's a lot of people that buy stocks and get greedy and try to trade. A lot of people, long-term investment. This is how they feel that they're going to be able to hedge against the negatives that are happening now so that they'll have money later.
Well, and I totally sympathize with people that have stocks yet, especially people my age that were ready to retire but haven't yet, and they didn't change their stocks into something more secure like an annuity or something, which just fickle fate that I did this all 3 years ago with all of my investments, which were teacher type investments, you know, pension issues and so on. I didn't have stock. I had some mutual funds that was part of a tax shelter annuity, to get technical here, and I transferred it to like fixed. So the percent goes down, but I've never lost anything in 3 years. And so, but I'm not one of, I'm one of the very fortunate few. Other people didn't think it would get this bad, and they're ready to retire, and they just can't now because they're, the money that they were counting on for retirement is down to maybe a third of what it was. So they have to keep investing, and maybe switching their stock to something that's a little bit better, and then switching again. So that's really the only choice they have, because they need to get the income back in there so that they can retire securely. And so that is an unfortunate thing. Maybe, can you do this in 3 minutes? Can you summarize Rich Lowry, who's a columnist in the Dearborn Times-Herald each week? He's the editor of the National Review, and that was William F. Buckley's magazine, conservative Republican journal. And Rich is young and intelligent, and he talks about the zombie banks and the Japanese situation. Could you just read maybe the beginning and summarize it in the next 3 minutes?
Well, I can even do it in less than that, because basically what happened is computer hackers managed to hijack a digital road sign in Austin, Texas. You know, the signs with the amber alerts and what have you, drive safe, drive slow type scenarios. Anyways, they changed the message to zombies ahead. And he was taking that as a whimsical warning that for that stretch of Texas road, it could serve as a kind of a parallel to the U.S. economy, and that zombie banks was the term for Japanese financial institutions, which were propped up by the government in the 90s, despite their basic insolvency after a real estate bubble. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah.
Okay, so in other words, his the whole crux of the article is basically saying that we're going to have very much of a problem using the path that we're taking in solving and financially backing up all these banks right now. Financial system has another $1 trillion hole in it that we haven't even addressed yet. We haven't even given them the remainder of the other money. So that's basically, I think everybody's heard about that for a long time.
Yeah, and they're just not bouncing back that fast. They tried some things that didn't work. Government money going in, and it's actually amazing to a lot of people that they always think of Japan as having a strong economy and, you know, selling a lot of products to the rest of the world. Folks, I think that's Korea now, not Japan. They just haven't done well. In fact, last night, there was some crawl on the bottom of one of those financial network screen. I couldn't figure out it was NIKKEI. It's dropped like 10, 12%, 22% or something. And what the heck is that? Well, I found out today that is the Japanese stock exchange. I don't know if they call it Nikkei. I don't want to say Nokia, because people think it's that Danish furniture company, but Nikkei or whatever, NIKKEI, and they had a big downturn too yesterday. So they're still not doing well over there. If you use the Dow averages or the stock market averages to mean something directly related to how the country, there is a difference there, folks. That's the only point we're trying to make on that. Let's end with some exciting event news. The Chamber is co-sponsoring this event. Maybe you can talk more with Jennifer next week about that.
Well, everybody's concerned, but if you happen to be outside and you're driving around and you're listening to us at 89.3 FM, you're going to notice it's a lot warmer. So it's thinking spring right now, and the Dearborn Area Board of Realtors are teaming up with the City of Dearborn to have a home and garden expo set for March 14th. And that'll be at the Performing Arts Center, the Ford Community Performing Arts Center. And what's really nice about it is the City of Dearborn is providing support, because admission and parking will be free.
Oh, free parking to die for, folks.
So now you can get some unique ideas on how to plant landscapes and create curb appeal for your home, which is losing in property value.
So there'll be sort of like the big auto or big home and builder show, which is now usually out in Troy sometime. I don't know when that's scheduled, but used to be downtown at Cobo Hall, but I don't think it's been there for a few years. This is probably some local companies too that'll have tables of information, but tips that you can use. You know, explore products and ideas to improve your home. Probably can't afford to sell your house in this market, so those a couple of nagging things that are still there that you said, well, I won't fix it till I have to sell my house. Well, maybe you just should make your life a little easier by fixing those problems, you know, whether it's inside or outside the house. So sounds like a great idea. That's the 14th, and I'll be gone. Oh, well. Is that just the one day?
Yes.
One day. So don't miss it, folks. It's
from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m.
Week from tomorrow, Saturday, March 14th.
And you'll be in Texas.
Yes. So I'll look for that Austin sign that was hacked. The Dearborn Symphony will perform tonight its annual Pops concert. I don't know what the moms are going to be doing, but Pops means popular music, but played with the full symphony, so symphonic version. But it's an adaptation. It really brings out the beauty, which you might not thought there was any, in a lot of pop songs. Of course, there'll be probably a lot of traditional Broadway hits I see that they're going to be doing. And I just want to mention that the vocalist, as well as the Vanguard Voices and HFCC Choirs, under the direction of G. Kevin Dewey. A lot of people don't know his first name. He goes by the letter G, but we all call him Kevin around here. But so he's going to be directing them, and he and his new wife, Anna, Kevin and Anna, are the two key vocalists for the program itself. I don't know what they're going to be doing, but they're featured in several numbers, including One Hand, One Heart. Very potent, very emotional. I wonder if it was a song at their wedding. I don't know. But so it's going to be a great thing tonight, and we've been announcing it, of course, during our classical music. But really, the pop music aspect, it's usually something that everybody can enjoy, even if they don't know exactly where the songs came from. They probably remember the melody. You know, they'll probably remember that because it's popular, okay? That's why they're doing this stuff. And so, of course, you can get tickets and other information. Concert tickets range from $10 to $30 for adults and $10 for students. And you can try to call the symphony office at 310-